Welcome, on behalf of the Library of JTS, to the latest of our faculty book talks. I'm going to get right down to business so that you have an opportunity to hear more from one of the editors and authors of one of the pieces in the book. Eitan Fishbane has actually been very generous with his time for these programs. He's speaking not only tonight, but he spoke for us about his earlier scholarly work, A Light Before Dawn, which was a wonderful work, and presentation was very much appreciated. To characterize this book for you, just to start off, you would probably imagine that a scholarly book, meaning one that's deeply engaged in, you know, kind of scholarly history and technical readings and footnotes and all of that sort of thing, would be far more difficult to write than a book intended for a broader audience, than a so-called popular book. You might think that, but if you thought that, then you, like me, would be mistaken. Because if you've ever tried to imagine what it means to take a complicated subject or a complicated set of texts and render them accessible for a broader audience, you will immediately understand the challenge that this book represents. This fights that battle, and it fights the battle elegantly. What this book is, for those of you who have not heard anything about it, and again, just brief introduction before introducing one of the editors, is a selection of mystical texts that relate to the spiritual life, all of which the authors of the individual brief essays claim can be extremely important and relevant for a spiritual life today. That's a tall order. To make a text that could be very difficult, accessible, and to explain in words that we can all access what its relevance or importance might be. So, speaking for myself here, reading from beginning to end, these were mostly texts that I knew nothing about, by authors that I knew very little about, and introductions or essays on these texts that provided me as an outsider, meaning an outsider, someone who doesn't study the Jewish spiritual tradition, as a kind of outside of this tradition, provided me with access that I had never before had to these texts. And that was just a wonderful treat to have that opportunity. So I encourage you all to dip into this. The book will be for sale after the presentation. It ordinarily sells for $25-ish, and we're selling it for exactly $20. So that is your discount for attending tonight, and I can assure you that after you hear Eitan's presentation, you will be even more inspired to take this challenge and try to find your way into these texts yourself, with the help of some of the most outstanding authors who consider seriously the kinds of texts that are brought together in this work. Really an astounding array of writers, and so if for nothing else, that would be an excellent reason to pick up the book. But there's a lot more here as well, and I'm far less prepared to tell you about it than the editor is. So, Eitan Fishbane, our dear colleague and friend here at JTS.
Wonderful. Thank you, Professor Kramer. It's true. This really this book represents an attempt to find that bridge between something that I think a lot of us care deeply about, and a lot of us are trying on a regular basis to figure out the right balance of to strike that balance between our, let's say, our academic scholarly work and our desire to communicate the relevance and the meaning of the great ideas of the Jewish tradition to a contemporary audience. This book emerged first and foremost as a 70th birthday present to my teacher, Arthur Green, who was my PhD supervisor at Brandeis University, and who has done a lot of work, especially in the contemporary spiritual project of bringing the texts of the mystical tradition, particularly those of the Hasidic mystical tradition from 18th and 19th century Eastern Europe to a modern contemporary audience in quest of a new, revived, renewed spiritual language. One of the great contributions of Professor Green, of Rabbi Green, to that whole contemporary project is the project of selecting, translating, and commenting upon a great well of spiritual sources that are otherwise inaccessible to a community of readers who are in search for a different kind of spiritual language, a different set of models for the theological imagination, a different way of thinking about the religious quest and the inner life. One of the orienting approaches of this book, and it's found in the formulation of the editor's introduction, of my introduction, is a reflection upon the way in which we as a contemporary Jewish community, particularly an American Jewish community, are both intuitively, inherently in quest of a different way of understanding theology, a different way of approaching God. Let's say a model of theology that is more rooted in the presence of divinity in the here and now, as opposed to the transcendence of God as the Avinu Malkeinu of classical Jewish theology that's so reflected in our liturgy. And one of the powerful images, one of the powerful theological models that's found in the mystical tradition and which has become so appealing to those, let's say, who, whether they would characterize themselves as neo-Hasidic or as spiritually inspired by the mystical tradition to, in the reformulation and adaptation, integration of Jewish ideas into their own theology, into their own construction of what God means in their lives, this message of radical divine presence has been exceedingly powerful. Now, this is one of the great teachings of the Hasidic movement. And we actually, when we set out to invite our various contributors to offer tribute, to offer their birthday present to Art Green, we invited them to select a particular mystical text from either Kabbalah, spanning really from medieval Kabbalah through 20th century Jewish mysticism, and then to offer a reflection on both on what the text means and how and why it's potentially spiritually powerful and meaningful for today. And the vast majority of those contributors chose texts from the Hasidic mystical tradition. A few chose passages from the Kabbalistic tradition. There are two passages from the Zohar, the late 13th century great classic of medieval Jewish mysticism. But the vast majority chose Hasidic mysticism, and this was actually very telling to us in the process, because it's a reflection of the fact that the theological and the spiritual message of Hasidic mysticism, which is one of divine immanence, of radical divine presence in this world, in the here and now, even to the point of a panentheistic, of God filling everything, in the sense of milokol haaretz kavodo, the whole earth, the earth is the fullness of God's glory, the whole earth is full of God's glory, even pushing it to a further point of that sometime dirty word pantheism, right, that everything is God. I guess as editors we want to push back against that idea that pantheism is not a Jewish concept, right? I think that in many ways that's one of the deep, powerful messages of the mystical tradition is what can be called monism or monistic theology, that God is not just to be understood as beyond and separate from the world in that vision of omnipotence and omniscience, right? That God is all-powerful and all-knowing, but rather that God is the great lifeblood and breath of all existence. In fact, God is the all of being. And this is one of the deep truths, deep teachings, or truths as it's understood by the mystics, especially in Hasidic mysticism. You can also say this of many Kabbalists as well from earlier periods, earlier centuries, but very much of the Hasidic tradition. So that message, I think, or that theological orientation really does run through the book, not necessarily by full design, but it sort of emerged as different people did their contributions. The other powerful teaching of Hasidic spirituality, of Hasidic mysticism, which I think is very much found in the book, is the orientation toward the spiritual life as one of questing inward to find that divine presence and to find the ways in which both a kind of divine spiritual light and a deep kernel soul of existence is found in each and every one of us, so that our spiritual lives must be a process of self-examination, of introspection, of looking inward to find that deeper hidden divine spark, and also seeking to find it in the face of the other. So before I read a few selections from the book to you, let me also.
Could you explain the face of the other, please?
I would say that the idea of how God's presence is to be found in the relational moment. Right. So both in a sense of self-introspection, right, a looking inward to find that divine presence, and then how that affects how we relate to other people, right? So that has a powerful effect on our ethical posture and on our attitudes of relation, right? If God is to be found in the face of the other, as well as in us, as well as in the world around, and this is a teaching that lies at the core, I would say, of Hasidic mystical tradition, and is one of the things that has been so appealing to contemporary Jewish spiritual seekers, I guess, as they would call themselves, right? Is the idea that divinity is to be found within, and that a major focus of spiritual language and of spiritual thought is, let's say, a moving of the point of focus from the metaphysical, or from the divine realm beyond, as is much more the case in Kabbalistic mystical discourse, to the spiritual psychology of the person, which is a central part of Hasidic mysticism. The great pioneering scholar, historian of Jewish mysticism, German-born Israeli scholar Gershom Scholem, argued that one of the primary ways in which Hasidic mysticism received and adapted earlier Kabbalistic mysticism was a translation and a reformulation of certain core ideas from the metaphysical world, from the world of God above, or the the heavens above, to categories of human consciousness, which is actually a very powerful concept, and that plays out in a number of the texts in this book and in the commentaries that a number of the wonderful contributors offer. So a quick example of that is, let's say, the category of the Ayin, Aleph Yud Nun, of the nothingness, of that the highest point of divine being in Kabbalistic discourse. The idea that as God, as this ever-flowing light and force of existence, seeks to become manifest, revealed, and known in the cosmos, and ultimately to the human mind, God begins as this state of nothingness, not as a lack or an absence, but what is translated as that which eludes human perception, that was beyond the grasp of the human mind, or that which is this, the deep mystery that is above perceivable reality. And then that Ayin, that nothingness, unfolds and translates into the being of manifest reality. So let's say we say with Jean-Paul Sartre, right, this moving from nothingness to being, or being and nothingness, right? Our experience of reality is that tension between that which is and we feel is real, and that which is the nothingness, or that which every college freshman asks themselves, right, in the dark of the night in the Matilda Schechter dormitory, what is reality? I did that as an undergraduate. So that's a great Kabbalistic concept, right, of the nothingness of being. So how is that translated in Hasidic mysticism? It's that we need to think, well, first it's as an ethical category, to pick up on your question, right, that we need to think of ourselves as nothing before the other person. We need to be able to see ourselves as nothing before the other person, and therefore have humility before the other person, right? An ideal that we should strive for, but often fail to achieve in our flawed humanity. And also, I would say that Hasidic mystics say that we need to constantly be trying to turn our focus on physicality, on the bodily, into a focus on the purely spiritual. So that's a return to this category of the Ayin. Or another example of this that's, let's say, perhaps a little bit less abstract. The Kabbalists spoke about two different states of divinity, one as katnut, kind of narrowness or smallness, and the other of gadlut, of expansiveness, and that these were two inner states of God, that God fluctuated between a kind of state of contraction and a state of expansion. In its metaphysical sense, it's rather confusing, but how was this understood by Hasidic mystics trying to translate into a kind of psycho-spirituality? It was that sometimes we are in a state, all too often, we are in a state of katnut, in a state of narrowness of mind, right? We can only see within our four cubits of reality, right? We can only see people in a way that objectifies them, the way Martin Buber spoke about the I-it relationship as opposed to the genuine I-you relationship. And Buber, by the way, was heavily influenced by this Hasidic idea. So all too often we're in a state of smallness of mind, where we're it's a kind of low state of thinking. We're not seeing the divinity in things. We're looking at people as objects to be used, as opposed to that greater state, which is gadlut, expansiveness of mind, where we're able to be fully present to the other person in relationship, where we're able to be so present to the world that we're able to see God's presence in it. And those moments of gadlut, the Hasidic mystics would say and say, are so ephemeral, are so fleeting, that they come and go like a flash of lightning. That's how the Hasidic mystics, that's how the Baal Shem Tov, the founding father of Hasidic mysticism, interprets that line from is the book of Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel's vision of the flashing lights of the angels, right? And they were the beasts of heaven were running to and fro, chayot ratzov ashov kimareh habazak, like the flash of lightning. And how does the Baal Shem Tov, how does the Hasidic mystic understand this? It's that our experience of spiritual illumination is often just like a flash of lightning that's there and then gone, right? It's there for a moment and then we're left in the darkness and we're left with that absence. It's like those moments of even great artistic experiences of the sublime, right? We're sort of overcome by the power of them, and then they're fleeting because of our finite humanity. So let me. I'll read to you a few sentences from the beginning of the introduction. This is actually the part of the introduction that I wrote. I might have the inside scoop. And how may we define this elusive phenomenon of spirituality? It is first and foremost a yearning to connect to the deep essence of things, a sense that there is a layer of existence that lies concealed beneath the surface of perception. It is this same quality that is reflected in the mystical sensibility. One of the reasons why the language of mysticism speaks to so many in our day. Right, so what I was saying there is an encapsulation of a core feature of how I would define Jewish mysticism in general. What orients the mystic? It is the intuitive belief that all of existence, all of reality, is shot through with divine meaning and mystery that is not immediately apparent to the outer eye. Right? We need to learn how to see the world not with the Ein HaBasar, the eye of the flesh, the physical eye, as Yehuda Halevi would say, the medieval religious poet, but rather with the Ein HaSeichel, with the eye of the mind, or even the spiritual eye, the Ein HaLev, the eye of the heart, which for him also meant the mind. We need to be able to see things at a deeper level, to be able to look at the world around and see reality as this series of doors and portals and traces through which the glimmers of the divine presence can become revealed and manifest to us, but only once we train our spiritual sight, as it were, to be able to encounter that, to be ready to receive it, only then can we open ourselves to that. But one of the things that we underscored in this book, and that a number of our contributors emphasize, and which we emphasize in the introduction, is that despite that almost universal mystical impulse to quest for the oneness of all things, for the deep divine presence that lies within all things, the Jewish mystic believed very firmly that this process is to happen within the structure of the life of mitzvot, within the encounter with the Torah, within the life of halacha and study, that the particulars and the contextual framework of the Jewish tradition defines that mystical quest in a way that is fundamentally different from the way it is defined by Christian mystics or Islamic mystics, right? Who, many of whom share common features of the mystical sensibility, but whose religious language is oriented, is structured according to the symbols, rituals, texts, and inherited legacy of that particular tradition. Yes.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Please.
I wonder if certain language that we use and that often is used by all of us doesn't take us away from that position that you just described. Language as introspection, which is not a spiritual language, it's a psychological language. Instead of awareness, kind of like you who will translate the Hebrew, but the awareness, which is a awareness of the heart rather than an awareness of I did analysis and I know that I do this because of this or that. The preparation for togetherness or ascent, it seemed to me that it's not so much an emptying and clear understanding of things, but rather a sensitization toward certain...
What was the last word? It was
sensitization.
Oh, sensitization, yeah.
Yes, of certain aspects of spirituality which are not in the material or scientific or psychological or psychoanalytic world.
Well, it's interesting. It's very interesting. Thank you. It's a very interesting reflection. And I think, let's say, one of the ways that I would distill part what you're saying is that there is a fundamental tension between. let me preface it by saying, even though mysticism is not synonymous with the irrational. As it's sort of been stereotyped, right? That is sort of, you know, it's nonsense, but there's philosophical logic or there's logical argument. At the same time, because it has its own system, it has its own way of understanding its inner logic. At the same time, there is something about the mystical language, which I think is part of what you're expressing, which is more in tune with the mysteriousness of poetry, right? Or the muteness and silence that we have when we stand before the sublime, in let's say in the form of a work of art or the majesty of nature, right? What is it to be struck mute by the mystery and majesty of the world, and to an extent, right? What language can we use to access that experience? And I think that the language that the poet uses to express that elusive experience, that the artist uses, that the mystic uses, is expressing something of that encounter with the ineffable, that encounter with the mysterious, right? And here I am consciously evoking Heschel's language as well, as he was somebody who was very influenced by the mystical tradition, right? That our stance before the mysterious becomes one of the wondrous and of the amaze of the state of amazement, because it's one that pushes us beyond the logic of other forms of language, and we need to reach toward the metaphorical realm of the poetic. So in referring to this issue also of the divine within as an underlying theme, I want to now call attention to a particular piece in the book by Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanovsky of this general neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. Rabbi Avanchei Chesed, and in his commentary on a piece from Rav Kook, Abram Isaac Kook, who was a great Jewish mystic of the early 20th century, not a Hasidic mystic, but certainly a very modern mystic. Let me read actually just a few lines from the actual text by Rav Kook and then Kalmanovsky's commentary. So commenting on this on a statement from the beginning of the book of Ezekiel, I am amidst the exile. This is Kalmanovsky's translation of Rav Kook. The I, the interior, essential self, whether of individual or community, can only be revealed in accordance with its purity and sanctity. The inner identity can be revealed only in proportion to its heavenly strength, soaked in the pure light of heavenly radiance, burning within. But God's anointed is the breath of our nostrils, from Lamentations. The Messiah's greatness, glory, and might are that he does not exist outside of us, meaning God and the Messiah. He is our breath. We seek Adonai, our God, and David, our king. We revere God and his goodness. We seek our eye. We seek ourselves. And we find. This is the Rav Kook is actually very, very dense and difficult. So let's actually hear what Kamenovsky has to say. People commonly repeat the Torah's phrase that we are created in the divine image, or draw from the Kabbalistic lexicon to say that we all contain a spark of divinity. While undoubtedly true, these have the ring of banal slogans, too metaphysically thin to point to real insight. Often we use these slogans only to mean that human beings are wonderful. But the logic of panentheism, of God being within all things, runs deeper, all the way to the ocean. And the ocean is never filled. There's Kalmanovsky as a poet also. Once we affirm that God is one and infinite, and also that God's image is inscribed in all people, and all creation for that matter, we find ourselves in deep waters. Within the world's vast diversity, primal unity inheres. Infinite depths dwell within every finite crumb of matter. Mystical consciousness seeks insight into this transcendent mystery within the world of brute facts, atoms, and molecules. I'm just going to read a few more sentences. Applying this panentheist awareness to human beings, we begin to intuit that we are not the little people we thought we were. The sacred depth of the human person is obscured through conventional consciousness, which affirms that each of us is a solitary, finite self who knows itself through its own inner mental process. Once we introduce the idea that divinity sparkles within us, however, we can say none of these things simply. It cannot be solitary or finite, at least not ultimately. Your limited aloneness dissolves as you participate in the universal life of God. And if the deepest part of yourself is the divine image, you cannot ever really get to the bottom of your own well. Your own heart will remain a mystery. But unless you intuit this unfathomable dimension within, you can never know who you are. So, Kalmanovsky reading Kook and expanding upon the ideas, right, is teaching us that one of the deep powerful messages of the mystical tradition is the idea that we are all interconnected, right? There is a sense in which at our deepest self, we share that divine light with all the other elements of this world, all the other people of this world, that there's a sense of wholeness and integratedness with the totality of God, right? The mystics claim, especially the Hasidic mystics, but you can make this generalization, that all of reality, right, the deep secret of the divine mystery is that all of reality is one interconnected whole, one great interconnected organism of life that lives and breathes as a single living force. And that all too often we exist on the plane of consciousness of katnut, right, I mentioned before, of narrowness, of smallness of mind, where we can't feel, we can't sense that deep interconnected oneness of all things. Only in those flashes of insight, of looking into our deepest well, our deepest heart, can we come to a vision of how our I, our self, is actually a part of a larger whole. let me turn to a piece here, the piece that I contributed to the volume, initially the introduction, editing, and so forth. There's a text from Rabbi Yehuda Leib Alter of Ger, the Sfat Emet, who was a great Hasidic mystical teacher from in late 19th century Poland, in the town of Giora Kalvaria, Polish town just outside of Warsaw, a major, highly influential and creative and charismatic Hasidic master who died in 1904. And one of the fundamental teachings of his work, the Sfat Emet, which means the language of truth, or at least that's an approximation of how we might, really it's the Sfat Emes, right? But it's an approximation of what he means by that five volume commentary on the Torah. The deep teaching there of his is that everything boils down to the power of Shabbos. And actually I have a much longer work on this that's coming out in the fall on Hasidic reflections about Shabbos, about the Sabbath, and this piece will also appear in a version there. But one of the ways in which the Sfas Emes latches onto this idea is the claim that Shabbat, the Sabbath, represents this deep inner stillness within us, that each and every one of us contains what he calls the nikuda timuna pnimit, this inner hidden point of divinity, like a spark that shines within and gives a kind of sense of stillness and tranquility to the religious life. For those of you who happen to have the book, this text is on page 185. And those of you who don't, remember the page, and then when you get your copy, you can take a look. Let me just read a few lines from here, and then I'll read you a little bit of my commentary. In the Midrash, it is taught, and this is in Midrash Breishit Rabbah, that the light of a person's face during Chol, during the weekdays, is different from the light of his face on Shabbat. This means that on Shabbat, the inwardness, the pnimiyut, which is a favorite Hasidic term, focusing on the way in which God is found within, is revealed. On Shabbat, the inwardness is revealed. As it is written, a man's wisdom lights up his face. This is the revelation of the extra soul, the neshama yetera, which the Kabbalists, building upon older traditions, argue is present on Shabbat in a different way, that each Jew receives an extra measure of soul that flows into them on Shabbat. So the revelation of the inwardness of the person is found because that's the revelation of the extra soul that's within them, and that allows us to be able to see that inner divine light and spark in a different way. And so too at large in the world. It's not just in the inwardness of the self, but also in the world around. This Hasidic master teaches there is that inner soul, that inner spark to divinity that is there waiting to be discovered. And during the week, it lies concealed. During the week, it's much harder to access because, as Sfas Emes says here and elsewhere, building upon the teaching from Ezekiel chapter 46, speaking about the future temple, right? There the prophet Ezekiel is envisioning the rebuilt temple because he's speaking in exile, right? And he says, right, Shara Chatzera Pnimi Yesagur Sheshet Yemei Maaseh Uviyom Shabbat Uviyom Chodesh Ipateach. Right. So during the 6 days of the week, this gate to the inner courtyard that faces east, speaking about the temple, will remain closed. But on the seventh day and on Rosh Chodesh, the first of the month, that gate will be open and you'll have access. They're speaking about a geographical, spatial prophecy. But the Hasidic mystics, and this goes back earlier to Kabbalists, but it's found very much in the teachings of the Sfas Emes, they say, what is that inner courtyard? What is that inner courtyard of the temple? It's actually the inner courtyard, the sacred space of the heart and the soul of the person. And that during the 6 days of the week, during ordinary time, we sometimes bump up against the obstacles to perception, right? It's harder for us to access the holy. And we're burdened by all of our worldly concerns, our labors, and our obsessions, and our whatnot, right? That during the week we're bombarded by that closed gate, and it's very hard to open that gate. But on Shabbat, he says, the gate to the inner courtyard of your heart opens wide. And you're able to access it in a different way. That Shabbat allows us an opening in perception. How are we doing with time? I don't know.
If you want to read your piece, yeah, maybe open up to
sure. That's great. Okay, great. So the way he leads this teaching, right, is that that light that shines in the inner soul, the inner heart of the person, and in the world, he says that this is what you should think about when you're lighting candles on Friday night. This is what Hadlakata Nerot, the secret, the mystery of Hadlakata Nerot. So it's a very powerful kavanah, very powerful intention for that simple yet incredibly powerful ritual of crossing, of threshold crossing, right, from the so-called profane to the sacred, from the ordinary to the holy. Right, because he says that this is as it is written by Yehi Or, let there be light, and thus the lighting of the Shabbat candles is a mitzvah that hints to the revelation of the hidden light on the holy Sabbath. The children of Israel anticipate the disclosure of the hidden light as they feel the darkness of this world. And then when the light of the candle is ignited, he wants to teach us, it's as though we need to think about our passing from that state of darkness in which it's harder to access the divine presence to that state of illumination when God's presence becomes much more readily available. And that's why we feel uplifted and transformed by the experience of Shabbat. Now this is me commenting on the text. The candles shine with an otherworldly glow, a reminder of the radiant presence that has begun to envelop us, transforming our ordinary space into a small sanctuary, a place made ready for God's dwelling. God is the pure light that pulses at the core of creation, the force of all that is. We yearn for that radiance in every unaware moment of our daily lives, crying out from the narrowness of superficial obsession, slowly finding our way to the bright gleam of divinity, and like the lover and beloved of the Song of Songs, we leap over mountains in quest of the heart of all hearts. So I think that's a good place to pause and to open it up for some discussion.
You mentioned Gershom Scholem, a great scholar, Jewish mysticism, including Hasidism. I was just wondering, in the suggestions for further reading, how could you leave out all of Scholem's writings, as well as those of his student, the great Yosef Dan?
I'm sure that Yosef Dan is probably going to be mad at me. It's a very good question, The goal of that suggested reading, I'd say, in addition to you know, telling readers about a couple of other things that the editors had written, was mostly about focusing on works that were specifically good introductions to the way in which this tradition can be adapted in our own day. And there certainly is some work in there that's of a more academic nature, but a lot of that list is about the ways in which the mystical tradition can be engaged as a contemporary Jewish seeker. And let's say as a lot of the scholarship that's in there, because there is a good amount of scholarship, is of a later, a more contemporary vintage. But I definitely hear what you're saying. Maybe we should have put him in there. Yes.
If the mystical tradition is a means by which man connects with the divine, surely it should be a universal type of conception. And when we link it specifically with the Shabbat, which is in a way unknown to the non-Jew, and we say in our prayers, it was not given to the non-Jew, it's given to us as some sort of a special gift. How can you link a truth to be revealed only to a Jew and not to the rest of the world?
Well, if anything crosses that boundary a little bit more than others, it's Shabbat, right? Because the as we heard in the lecture by Judith Shulevitz last month, in her fine book, The Sabbath World, reflection, not just reflection on the Sabbath, but Sabbath practice and its meaning was far from limited to the Jews, right? I mean, this was a major practice in Christian society. In its various denominations, but I think what you're asking is something slightly different, which is, well, is mysticism about this core universal experience, or is it about something more particular to a specific religious tradition? And what I would say is that it's a meeting point between the two. That historians of religion, theorists of religion, have long struggled, and a lot of this has focused around the question of mysticism because of that deep commonality of the sense of oneness, of the sense of the immediacy of divine presence, of a sense of encountering the light of God and so forth. Deep commonalities of imagery and idea. Philosophers of religion, theorists of religion have asked the question, well, can we speak about a deep universal core that cuts across religious boundaries, and that is sort of mysticism in the abstract, right? Removed from specific religious traditions. And some have said that that's possible. And then others have made the other extreme claim, which is that we can't speak of mysticism or any religious experience for that matter, any encounter and understanding of God, apart from the highly contextual culture, society-specific, text, ritual-specific fabric of a specific, particular religious tradition. That is to say, that Christian religious experience is going to be fundamentally different from Jewish religious experience, and so on, for, you know, Native American, Islam, and so forth. Going to be fundamentally different because of the web of symbolic, ritual, textual associations and ideas that go along with that. And so the question of whether we can speak about some universal common core or something highly contextual, I think my own feeling about it is that there is something in between, that there are elements of religious experience, of mystical experience in particular, that are reflective of our common humanity, and then there are also things that are totally defined by the ways in which different religious people practice their faiths.
Yes. You said earlier that this Jewish mystical tradition is confined within the mitzvot. And I think by saying that, you're kind of somewhat eliminating, and I'm not saying eliminating in a negative sense, but just in the context that we're looking things through a Jewish lens, if you will.
Right. Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say that it's impossible to have something approximating a Jewish mystical experience, and certainly not a mystical experience, without entirely without the language of the mitzvot. How in other words, there are things that can be, that could be. However, in terms of, let's say, imagery and Hebrew language. That said, in terms of the way in which the mystical texts and the mystics who wrote them understand the nature of that spiritual practice, it's totally bound up in interpretation of the words and letters of the Torah, the Hebrew language of the Torah, and of the web of commandments and behaviors that emanate from that Torah and its subsequent interpretation, such that a major branch of mystical thought is what we would call ta'amei ha-mitzvot, or the reasons, the explanations for the commandments. And a major one of the major points of focus for in mystical sources is symbolically interpreting all the various gestures and forms of speech that go along with the ritual life of Judaism through a mystical lens, right? What does it mean to put on tefillin, right? What does it mean to wear tefillin for a mystic? It's something very specific in the sense of how it reflects different dimensions of God, and how in the wrapping of the tefillin one is drawing down divine energies, and how the tefillin that you wear on the head, the tefillah you wear on the head, is different from the one that you wear on your arm because of its impact on different dimensions of God. In other words, their whole worldview of how human actions affect the divine world becomes read into, they wouldn't say it that way, becomes read into the ritual behaviors of the tradition. So it's not just the, let's say, the narratives and the words of the Torah, but it's also the very specific, highly kinesthetic elements of Jewish ritual life.
I thought of connecting the passage of Rabbi Kut with something that you read, and it's that the reason for Shabbat to be so central. First, I would like to say one thing, and it's that the fact is that Judaism was not a religion for the Jews, but was for a religion for those that will follow Judaism, which is a different thing. Judaism was even said by some prophets to be a light unto the nation. In other words, you pass it on. The fact that other nations which wish not to take it is a separate story. It seemed to me that Shabbat has an enormously profound central position as a mitzvah, because it's something that has been done by everyone at the same time, which makes for a powerful Am Israel. All of a sudden, it's not that individual selves, individual Jews, go to the ocean, but that everybody is part of that ocean. That produces, I would think, a special situation for the possibility of that extra neshama for Saturday.
That's an interesting way of framing it, right? That there is a sense of the individual within the communal.
Because it seemed to me that Judaism in general, particular mystical Judaism, is an un-Israel Judaism. It's a Judaism of community. It's not a religious mysticism of individuals having their vision, and that is the mystical situation, but rather the community. And that makes a tremendous difference with other mystical experiences of other religious people in other religions. The other thing is the special position of the Shabbat candles, the orb, and the correlation, if I will use that word, with the menorah in the temple. And that in that moment, the menorah was in the inner sanctum without being in the inner sanctum, so that all Jews, all Am Israel, was able to partake for a moment, for a day, with the aura of the divinity. That closeness is repeated every Shabbat. And it seemed to me that it's a unique moment and experience to experience oneself, using psychological terms, but in a special way, similar to the person putting on tefillin. And it's that the guf, the body, is the temple, before God.
He's yes.
Not just
yes.
In flesh.
It's very nice.
Let's take one last comment.
Sure. Was there somebody who didn't get a chance to speak yet, or otherwise? Sorry. No, that's fine. Yes, sir, in the back.
Yeah, I actually just wanted to suggest to the gentleman who raised the question about the universality of mysticism and the specificity of ritual. I'd just like to commend to your attention Dr. Fishbane's teacher's new work, Radical Judaism by Art Green, in which the way he discusses it is a paradigm that I think you will find extremely interesting. That there's a universal intuition that there is something, but religions, including Judaism, are communities' responses to that felt something.
Hmm. Very nice. Very nice. Yes, I mean the way in which I think that this is both how
he's, I think, yeah, in that formulation, unfortunately, he's given prophecy rather short shrift, but that's another matter.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, and I think that, very quickly, I think that part of what both of you are saying is that the power of the spiritual quest within the Jewish tradition, as within other spiritual traditions, is that, particularly in Judaism, dynamic relationship between the solitary quest and its situation within society, within the community, which is so very important. Yeah.
So on behalf of all of us and the library, I'd like to thank Professor Fishbane for your presentation and for providing us just with an opening to this book. Those of you who would like to make your way into the opening and pursue many of the other pieces, and it's a very, very rich array of both texts and commentaries, there are copies of the book available, and I'm sure that Professor Fishbane would be happy to sign copies and have a little conversation on the side. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.